WCRFM.
Chris Allen.
Chris Allen.
This is WCRFM.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast brought to you in association with WCRFM, which you can hear on 101.8 or via WCRFM.com or by telling your smart speaker to play WCRFM. On this week's podcast, we'll be hearing from Jude Aston talking about his journey towards being a sports reporter and the tough decision to have a leg amputated is bringing a new freedom. Councillor Beverley Mimenabardi, who's a cabinet member for Children and Young People, along with Jude, will also be talking about the new health app for citizens of Wolverhampton. Cherry Shine is the managing director of Wolverhampton Business Improvement District, and she'll be telling us all about the Business Excellence Awards, and businesses can join in lots of different categories there. Deadline is the 21st of April, so don't hang about. Superintendent Simon Inglis with feedback on the Women and Girls Safety Survey, and more importantly, how the findings are going to be used. And John Raj of the Bilson Support Network Community Shop, the Strengthening Families Hub there, will be talking about the community shop there and how it's supporting people in these very difficult times. Also in the show notes, you'll see the links to all other shops around the city as well. And finally, Jan Burns, MBE of Beacon Vision, will be talking about the training on offer to support local businesses to support their employees with visual impairment. If you ever have any stories or news, then you can always email me, chris@wcrfm.com, and I look forward to getting your information we can put on WCRFM and also in this podcast. First of all, though, Jude Aston caught up with Debbie Hookston and I on our Sunday morning show. We wanted to find out how he'd been getting on. Here he is. And it is the greatest pleasure to welcome into the studio Jude Aston. Jude, it worked out, it's 3 years since we sat in the studio together, mate.
Yeah, it's crazy. Good to be back, though.
But we worked in between then because we did a sports show together, didn't we?
Yeah, in lockdown, didn't we? That was a good show.
You were online. Were you in hospital or at home at the time?
I was at home at the time, but I was in my bedroom. I was bed bound, and we were talking, weren't we?
We were indeed.
We did a great show.
Well, you did the show. I was sitting in the studio pressing all the buttons, and you've done all the interviews down the line. Absolutely brilliant. So 3 years, it's been a mammoth 3 years for you on your journey, which is the way you obviously express your route to being a sports journalist. And most recently, obviously, people have seen in the news you made the brave decision and logical decision, I know, to have your leg amputated so that you got more manoeuvrability. Any second thoughts on that one? You know, you were very clear in all the stuff I've seen.
Yeah, I knew I wanted it. I knew it was the right decision. You mentioned that it was a brave decision. It was a really brave decision, but it wasn't a hard decision because I just knew it was the right thing. My leg was no use to me. I'd spent 2 years in hospital trying to get as much out of it as possible, and there was just nothing there with it. So I made the decision. I asked the doctors to do it, and I had to persuade them. But eventually, we got there in the end, and yeah, I had it on the 12th of December, and it was 100% the right decision. I can do so much more now, and yeah, I'm so pleased I've made it.
The fact that you're in the studio with us is probably testament to that, because again, travelling in a car was difficult, if not impossible, getting here, and it is so good to see you, and it is a brave decision to do that. But I could see through all the interviews and in the chats and in the messages we swapped, you were 100% convinced this was going to change your life, and it's beginning to.
Yeah, definitely. Like you say, you mentioned there about getting in the car, coming here today. I've come in the car. I've now got a fold-up wheelchair. Just on Friday, I took a delivery of a fold-up wheelchair so I could get it in the car. Those are things that I wouldn't have been able to do. It's the little things like sitting in the car, like when I go to the Villa matches, I can sit on the coach next to my friend, using the toilet. Just little things, clothing. So a big operation like this, you wouldn't think it would be the little things that really do change your life, but trust me, it really has changed.
And you're having lots of physio, I assume.
Yeah, so lots of physio. So pre-amputation, we didn't know how far my hip could come down because my leg was stuck in a position towards my chest, so my hip was very tight and very contracted. Post-amputation, since the bottom half of my leg has came off, it's come down a lot further than we expected it to, and surgeons have said that I'm exceeding expectations, to the point where they said that there is a possibility in the future that in some shape or form I can use a prosthetic. Well, so the reason that I'm doing lots of physio and lots of work around my hip is to try and get it as far down as possible, because the medics have said that the further my hip comes down, the better type of prosthetic I can have. So, you know what I'm like, Chris, when they tell me I can have something, I want to try and get it.
I know, you're one of the most determined people I've ever known in my life.
Truly.
And an inspiration, you know, and you know, I've had a few leg problems. And every time I sort of think, feel sorry for myself, I think of you. And I think, put it in perspective, Chris.
I think it's that word resilience. I've just, you know, this is the first time I've met Jude, and I just had the pleasure of escorting him from the car park up here. And the small time we've just spent together, the energy that this young man gives off is just, it's contagious. We need to bottle it.
Indeed, we will. We'll bottle it and we'll sell it. I'm obviously on a journey to be in a sports reporter, and you're going to be on my second show today as well. We're just going to do sport on that one. That was going to be a bit of fun to do as well. But, you know, it's just good to hear your story. And you were telling Debbie beforehand about who inspires you.
Yeah, so Jack Rutter, he used to be an England cerebral palsy footballer, actually an ambassador at the Wolves Foundation at the moment. And yeah, I went to meet him a few years ago, one of the first interviews I did on my journey, where I went to the St George's Park and interviewed all the England cerebral palsy players. And I've kept in contact with Jack. He'd been really supportive. He did a talk at my school at the Legacy Sports Awards. So Jack Rutter is someone that I can really relate with, because he's shown to me that despite having cerebral palsy, despite having the disability, he can still do something he loves, and he captained England at cerebral palsy level. So yeah, that's why I look up to him.
You and I did a piece for Cerebral Palsy Day a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember it well because you did a little film. It's still on YouTube there. And the only downside about it was it had my lockdown hair. Featured there as well.
I think you've still got that, haven't you, Chris?
Well, yeah, I know. I said earlier, need to get a haircut. But this is something that you were born with, and it's been a struggle right through your life. I know you had fantastic support from your family.
Yeah, like you say, I've had it since I was born, and I've had multiple operations trying to correct parts of my cerebral palsy. A lot of them on my leg, some on my arm as well, which has helped. And yeah, like I say, I've had lots of support from family and medical doctors as well. And it was actually one of the operations that actually brought on my chronic regional pain syndrome. Right. So I had cerebral palsy, and then I had an operation in January 2020, which is when just after I saw you in the studio. And after that, I developed the complex regional pain syndrome, which basically meant that my body overreacted to the surgery. Because I had so many operations in my life, my body just said, no, I've had enough, stop messing with me, kind of thing. And yeah, that's when things sort of started to develop and got worse, and that's right. When I had to go into hospital to try and correct the complex regional pain syndrome.
So we were talking earlier, weren't we? And I was asking you, what is cerebral palsy? Because there's confusion out there, isn't there?
Yeah, so there's lots of different forms of cerebral palsy. It's not just one size fits all. For me, I've got hemiplegia, which means it affects me on the right side of my body. So all of my right side is affected, to my arm and my leg. Some you can have quadriplegia, which means all limbs are affected. Some on the opposite side to me, so on the left hand side. Some can affect have problems with speech. But I think the main myth about cerebral palsy that isn't true is that everyone who has it is in a wheelchair. No. And that's not true at all.
Mm. Yeah.
And you were telling me about Jack, because Jack's was later onset, wasn't it? He wasn't born with cerebral palsy.
Yeah, so Jack had an unfortunate event. He was out on the night out, and he got punched in the back of the head, and he didn't remember the days after that. He was admitted to Bristol Hospital.
Gosh.
And he had a very long journey ahead of him, and it was at that point they realised he had damage on his brain, and that meant that he had problems in his
upper
arm.
So he came from a brain injury later in life. I think what's absolutely amazing about you, and I know Chris will agree with me, is just your drive. You can hear it in your voice. And I asked you a quick question, and I know Chris is going to ask you something in a minute, but a quote, the mantra that you live by, do share it.
So this is actually true. I was lying in my bed when I was bedbound. I was struggling a lot, I'll be honest. And I remember my family buying me a quote book, and it's got loads of quotes, and still got it today. And I remember reading, "The man who moves a mountain begins by taking away the small stones." And to me, that just summed up everything, because this journey has been exactly that. Everything I've had to do, it's been a journey. I've had to remove small stones. So I got to the point where I couldn't touch any of my leg because of how sensitive it was. It was that painful, and I had to desensitize it. So I had to remove that stone. Then once I've removed that stone, I had to work on getting in a wheelchair, and then I had to remove that stone. And then the big, big stone is the surgery I've just had, the amputation. I had to work out to persuade people to do it, and I've removed that big stone now. And now the next big stone I'm working towards is trying to use a prosthetic, whatever shape or form that will be.
Right. No, I'm, you know what? I'm rather glad you just said that you had a bad time, because I've never known you communicate being in a dark place. But there must have been times when you were in a very dark place.
Yeah, I was. There was for the first 2 years of my chronic pain syndrome, I was in a bed. I was in a bed in my room, upstairs on my own, and it was tough. It was really tough. And you know, I only noticed that once I went into hospital, because I didn't realise how much being in my room and being just isolated in my bedroom actually held me back. When I went into hospital, you'd think going into hospital would be a worse place. It's not a very, very nice place. But for me, going into hospital actually gave me more freedom, because I wasn't stuck in my room, isolated. I had the nurses coming in to me, saying hello to me. And that's when things started to actually really open up, because we realised that a big part of the problem was me psychologically being trapped in my room upstairs. And you with the physical presentations that I was showing, so like you say, my leg was stuck up on towards my chest. I couldn't touch any of my leg, even like if someone was to breathe on towards my leg, I'd be in agony and in pain. It'd be those little things, and it would all come out in physical presentations. So the way I was feeling psychologically showed in my physical presentation.
Now, amazed, and you know, thanks for sharing that, because I think the things that you've been sharing in terms of, you know, moving those stones one by one, and also the journey you've gone and the brave decisions that you've made, and I think, and also then saying it's been tough, you know, and that chronic pain over that time, and I didn't realise, you know, we've been in touch quite regularly. How long have you been in hospital? You know, that kind of always took me by surprise. But you always gave a shout out to the staff there as well, because they've been fantastic for you, haven't they?
Yeah, the staff at New Cross were brilliant with me and really supportive. When you're an inpatient in hospital for that long, you get to know the surroundings. And it got to the point where, because I was in there for so long, I was nervous about coming out of hospital.
Right.
Because, yeah, that makes sense.
Because you're just in there, you get used to the environment. It's like a military exercise every single day. It's the same routine. You wake up at 7 o'clock. Yep. They do your observations, and then the doctors come around, and then you do the physio, and it's just the same every single day. And I had that for a year plus. So it was very repetitive.
That's Jude Aston talking about his journey. He stayed in the studio with me for when Councillor Beverley Mamenabadi joined us online, because Jude had been working on this new health app.
Joining me on the line here now, joining us, I should say, because Jude's still here, is Councillor Beverley Mamenabadi, who's Cabinet Member for Children and Young People. Good afternoon, Bev.
Afternoon, Chris. Hey, Jude. Good to be with you today.
That was good. And we're going to be not talking children and young people for once, although children and young people are included on this. We're talking this incredible Get Healthy app. Tell us about it. We might have a delay with you, Bev. Can you hear me?
Yeah, so Wolverhampton is really excited to have been chosen. It's probably me. I don't know if you can hear me a bit better now. Wolverhampton have been chosen. We're really, really excited to be part of a new health initiative called Better Health Rewards. And the idea is that anyone who's 18 and over in Wolverhampton can sign up and be incentivized to do two things, which are to move more and to eat better. So the idea is that you download the app, you fill in a quiz or I guess a profile about yourself. You can be sent a fitness tracker a couple of days later, and you take part in the program, which sets you challenges. So it could be things, Chris, like increase your step count by 100 steps today. It all links into the app, and as you are doing those challenges, you can earn rewards. So anything from supermarket vouchers to gym passes, cinema tickets, and family days out.
It's really exciting. It's obviously going to cost a lot of money, this. Where's that all coming from? Is that the city council? Is it central government? Is it a mixture of everything? Where's it coming from?
So it's central government money. The you know, the idea is that we want people. So Wolverhampton's been chosen not because of any particular health issues that are different to anywhere else in the country, but actually we're the right population size. We've got a track record of being able to get out there into communities. And we want to support residents to make those better, healthier life choices. There is a lot of money going to this, a couple of million pound. And, you know, I'll just give you an example of some of the benefits, Chris. So if you think about the current cost of living crisis, for example, I think that everything's actually stacked against people to make those better, healthier life choices at the moment. So if you think of, you know, say a family of four, to go to the supermarket, you've got to put fuel in the car, you've got to buy healthy ingredients, you've then got to put gas and electric on to cook those ingredients. Actually, walking to the bottom of your road and, you know, buying, I don't know, a bag of chips, for example, might be a little bit cheaper, but obviously not the right health choice that we want people to have. So if we can incentivize people, offer them those supermarket vouchers, healthy food vouchers, to be able to make those better health choices, it's absolutely what we want to do.
Brilliant, Bev. It is breaking up occasionally, so but we can just about hang on in there with you at the moment. You talked about Wolverhampton not being particularly bad from a health point of view, but there are lots of health inequalities across the city, aren't there? I've talked with John Denley, Director of Public Health, about this before. That as you move across the city, then health gets worse and even life expectation gets worse.
It's an obesity crisis, you know, not that especially prevalent more than anywhere else to Wolverhampton. But just as an example, in 2021, obesity cost the NHS over £6 billion. So actually, we think that this programme is worth its weight in gold. If we can get people to make those better, healthier life choices, that will in turn put less pressure on the NHS. And these some of these health issues can be controlled by better dieting, more exercising. We met a 74-year-old woman on Friday with Jude when we launched this, when we launched the project, who told us that actually she has diabetes, but through making better health choices around food and around moving more, she's not had to take medication for that yet. So we know it can work.
Brilliant, brilliant. We're just cracking up a bit. I'm going to chat to Jude. You mentioned him there, Bev, he's in the studio with us. Jude, you've been working on this because you're part of the communications team at the City Council and been working on this in particular because of your health remit within this. So you're excited. And what about the kind of people you were meeting on Friday?
Brilliant for young people like me to be involved in. And I think it's been a brilliant campaign. Friday was a brilliant launch. So we've all been working towards that day and it went really well. We had a brilliant reception. And yeah, I think it's just an exciting new project.
And this is for all ages as well, obviously, as well. You're a sports person, but this is for all people all ages, and it's just about generally getting healthy.
Yeah, all people over 18, people who live in Wolverhampton, you can sign up via the app. And yeah, getting healthy, you'll have daily challenges set, you'll get a free fitness tracker. So why wouldn't you want to get involved?
Absolutely, especially the incentives there as well. And Bev, I'll give out the details in terms of where people can go to this. But do you think it can make that big an impact on people? You talked about the cost of living crisis. I'll be chatting to John Raj later about the community shops that are helping people with regard to that. Do you think this is going to make a difference and there's enough money in it for people to say, yes, I'll give it a go?
Yes.
You heard me, OK.
I do think it's going to make a difference. I think, as I said, things are stacked against people at the moment with lots of things that are going on in the world to make better, healthier life choices. And if we can give people that little bit of a push, that motivation to get up off the couch, to get some more steps in to make those healthier life choices. We know that when you start doing these things, normally people tend to sustain them. And although this is a pilot for 6 months to, I guess, tell the government whether it works or not, we know that people will, you know, be able to keep the fitness trackers. They'll have them after 6 months, so they'll still be able to take part in this, you know, in their own time, in their own leisure, without being part of the programme. So, yeah, I do think it will work. Just to say on the, who is it for? So it's for everyone in the city who's over 18. We do have a children's version of this, I would say, called Beat the Street, which happens every summer. And that's about getting kids and children out, tapping sort of boxes around the city, earning rewards as well. So this is almost our adult version of this. And we do have a children's one coming up in the summer, which is funded by the council.
Thank you, Beverly, very much indeed. And sorry, it's been a bit of a not such a great line. We heard you very clearly. We've got Jude who can build on that as well. But I'll give out the information now on that and let you go. But thanks as ever. Thank you. Thank you. And if you want to know more information, sorry, it was a bit of a bad line there, you go to wolverhampton.gov.uk/rewards. Everyone can earn at least £40 of rewards by taking part, and you get your Fitbit as well, Jude. Do you live in the city, or are you just outside it?
No, I live in the city, live in Penn.
So you qualify for this?
Yeah, I've signed up.
You've signed up. Good man. So it is for everybody. If you live in the city, it's worth a go. Go to wolverhampton.gov.uk/rewards.
That's Councillor Beverly Mamenabardi, Jude Aston with us as well. In fact, in the show notes, you'll find a YouTube video telling you how you can apply for your health app. Cherry Shine is the Managing Director of the Wolverhampton Business Improvement District, and they've got some new business awards. It's great to welcome Cherry Shine, who's the Managing Director of the Wolverhampton Business Improvement District, or the BID, as it's more easily called. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Are you?
Okay, and how's business? That's the more important thing, probably, especially in the city of Wolverhampton.
Yeah, no, we're always really busy. You know, there's always something to be done. You know, we've got an audience of over 400 city centre businesses that we need to make sure that we're doing the best for. So, yeah, always busy.
And you've got these wonderful Excellence Awards you've now launched. Tell us a bit about that, because I think you've been waiting for a while to find the right time to get this launched after COVID.
Yeah, so we really appreciate the fact that so many of our businesses, in fact, all of them, have been through a really tricky time through COVID, and we thought that was the end of it. Of course, it's not. It's now a cost of living crisis. It's really thrown a spanner in the works. But, you know, we've seen our businesses, they are agile, they are positive, they are you know, sort of resilient, and we really want to celebrate that. And we just thought, naturally, the BID Excellence Awards gives us a real opportunity to do that, to shine a light on all of their hard work.
So tell us a bit about the awards that people can win.
So we've got 12 categories. We want to celebrate all of the types of business in our city centre. We've got excellence in hospitality and leisure. So for your sort of nightclubs, your bars, maybe your casinos, your theatres, that kind of thing, through to excellence in health and beauty and wellbeing. Professional services, we've got excellence in retail. We've got marketing activity of the year, rising star, bounce back champion. That one's particularly aligned to, you know, just seeing how people have adapted and businesses have adapted to the changing circumstances. And a couple more. We've got a couple of ones where people can nominate their favourite business as well, just to engage the public, because everybody has an opinion on which is their favourite business and the reason why they love it. So, yeah, we've given them.
You've got a pretty wide coverage there. So there is something for everybody within there.
There really is.
And I like the unsung hero. That's obviously one of the public nominated ones as well. And what are you looking for within that one in particular? Just people who perhaps aren't noticed normally?
Yeah, people that sort of kind of go under the radar but are always there. They're part of the fabric of that business and part of the success of that business. You know, they might always turn up and do a really, really good job. There might be somebody that, you know, is always going the extra mile. It's just part of their nature. So it's really trying to give an opportunity for them to be celebrated, because we know how important they are. And how, you know, how much a business's success relies on people like that. You know, it's a fundamental part of success.
And, you know, we've moved in not far away from you recently, and we have Shop Local as one of our big slogans that we put alongside Listening Local as well. And some of the messages coming out of the BID recently about being positive, thinking positively about the city, but above all, sort of thinking how you build up the economy, and everybody have a bit of an impact by shopping locally, can't they?
Yeah, so our sort of motto is be proud, be vocal, do more, shop local. And that absolutely runs through everything that we do. Sometimes we change that motto just to be spend local, because, you know, even if it's not retail, it might be professional services, offices, services that you might need. You know, everybody needs support and help, you know, and we want to keep our city centre businesses thriving. So that's the reason why we follow that campaign. And, you know, it's just part of the core work that we do as a business improvement district.
And are there some businesses struggling a bit more than others? Obviously, lots of changes in the city centre over the past couple of years, as well as the pandemic. So it's not been an easy time. But have some areas of business struggled more than others?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the people not coming back to the office in the same way as some of the sectors. You know, it's a real shame to see there's some downturn in the numbers of people that might be buying their lunch at dinner time, or the, you know, because there are just less people in that sort of field coming back into the city centre. So we have noticed a bit of a downturn in that, but things are picking up. People are realising that they miss coming into the city centre. They miss those opportunities to, you know, multitask, get your get everything sorted at lunchtime or any breaks, or go out for drinks after work, that kind of thing. So we are seeing an increase, but yeah, there are some bits that are more affected than others.
So you've got these excellence awards. How can people find out more? Enjoywolverhampton.com is your website, and just go to there and look for awards.
Yeah, so if you just look for awards, it's right at the top. Click on that, and there's all the details about all of the categories that you can enter. So we'll accept a written entry, an audio or a video entry, just to make it more flexible. You know, people are very able to produce their own little video and send it in, because people naturally do that more than they would have done in the past. So yeah, and you can enter online. The closing date for entries is the 21st of April, so they've got quite a long time to just think about which category is best for them, which one shines a light on their business, and which one, and they can enter many if they want to. So, you know, we're not just asking them to enter one. They can, you know, try and promote their business through the awards, through a number of entries, you know, if they've got particular specialisms or stuff that they want to celebrate.
So we'll keep nudging people, because they tend to forget these things as we get towards the 21st of April. Yeah. But 21st of April is the deadline, and then you've got a big ceremony lined up for July time.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really excited to have our ceremony at Grand Station. It's an absolutely stunning venue. We can't wait. We're planning some really good entertainment as well, which I'll keep under the hat for now. But yeah, we want to, you know, it'll be a night of celebration, absolutely, and fun as well. We want people to really enjoy themselves and take pride in the fact that we, you know, they deserve celebrating, and we want to give them that. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. That's the 13th of July at Grand Station.
Thanks, Sherry, and all to your team and all the fantastic work you do to support our city centre businesses. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Sherry Shine, the Managing Director of Wolverhampton Business Improvement District. If you go to the show notes, you can see the link there to apply for an award. Don't forget, the closing date is the 21st of April, so don't hang about. There's been a survey being held across the city of Wolverhampton in recent times looking at the safety of women and girls. Superintendent Simon Inglis has come along to tell us some feedback from that survey, and especially how the findings are going to be used. I'm very pleased to say joining me now is Superintendent Simon Inglis of the Neighbourhood Policing Team in Wolverhampton. Simon, nice to see you.
Oh, good afternoon, Chris, and thanks for having me back.
No, well, you did promise to come back and talk about the survey with regard to the safety of women and girls. How's it gone? Did you get good response? What have you learned?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. And, you know, it's nice to follow this through. You know, I've been on a couple of times now and talked about our ambition and that we wanted to fully understand both policing and community safety, to understand how safe do people feel within the city. And we talked about the survey, and we were looking for people to contribute to that. So the updated position on that is that we had a great response. I'm really, really pleased. And I would just like to thank everybody who took the time to complete it. Nice. In that, you know, over 2,200 people fully engaged with the process itself and the survey, and we've got over 1,200 fully completed surveys, and there were a large number of questions on there. We wanted to get some detail, and over 1,200 people have taken the time to fully complete that. And what's really nice is the fact that it was 95% completed by females. We opened it up to all sexes so they could give their perspective.
Yeah.
But also across the demographic, it absolutely reflected that of those that live, work and visit Wolverhampton. So that was good to see. We reached everybody.
And the next question is, obviously, what are you going to do with all those findings? How's it going to shape what you do and how the city can be made safer?
Well, that is the most important part in all of this, because there is two stages, clearly, in the terms of you saying, and then it's what we do next, which is the most important point. If I could just touch on a couple of the things that came out from the survey, if that's okay.
Please,
Chris,
do. Yeah, yeah.
And whilst it's still, you know, quite high level and top line at the moment, you know, that it is absolutely clear that 75% of people felt really safe within the city during the day. That number does drop considerably when it comes to nighttime, because obviously the darkness and the fear, and you start to bring in things like alcohol and unwanted attention, etc. And all of a sudden that level does drop. And around 30% of our respondents were saying that they felt unsafe during the night. And that's something that we absolutely have to consider, because it's great that so many people did feel safe, and it's good because Wolverhampton is a safe city. However, we need to understand why people felt unsafe and when. And so unwanted attention from males was one of the key areas that came out. Those people that abuse alcohol and then think it's appropriate to engage with women in a certain way. Actually, congregation of youths that actually then cause women to feel intimidated was some of the key highlights. And, you know, there's, and I'll go on in a moment to talk about what we're going to do about those issues. But also we ask people what they think we can do as a city to improve that. And they've talked about, you know, better lighting in places where it's not well lit, in subways and in parts of the city centre. Improve CCTV so people feel secure when they go out. Improvements on our transport networks as well. You know, people talked about pockets of feeling unsafe on all forms of transport, whether that be bus, train, taxi, etc. And so these are all areas of business that we're then going to focus on. And one of the others as well that has come out through this survey is about the need to educate men about what does cause fear within women and girls within the city, because some may see some of their activities as being a little bit just over the line. But actually, it's really upsetting for women to feel unsafe. And so we need to educate men as well around what is the best thing to do and how to behave, so that we've got a whole city that is actually against this behaviour, that shows that we won't tolerate it. And men have got a huge part to play in making sure that women do feel safe.
You've answered my next question, which was, you've obviously talked about the practical ways you can change the design of the city, the design of transport, etc. But challenging behaviour is at the very, very heart of this. So what are the ways in which, as citizens, we can challenge behaviour?
It's a really good point, Chris, because the police can't do this in isolation. And with partners, we can enhance and protect. But ultimately, this is about culture as well. And that men who come into the city that behave in a certain way towards women need to know that everybody's out there looking out for the safety of women, and that it will be reported. And if I can just touch on that for one moment, Chris, in the fact that one of the areas of business that we talked about within the survey is that 30% of women and men that had witnessed unwanted behaviour and sexual harassment towards women hadn't reported it to the police.
Right.
And then when asked why that might be, because we wanted to understand why as well, there was a clear perception there that people feel that the police wouldn't take any action. Now, it's easy for me to sit here and say we absolutely will take action and please call us, and that is an overriding message. But it's important that even if people haven't actually called the police, if they have a fear that nothing is going to be done, we have to challenge that, and we have to change that perception. So the first part I would say is please to give all residents that confidence that if you do see it, please do contact us. We will react to it, and we do need to know. So that's that start point. We can put the infrastructure, the lighting and the video, but actually it's about changing people's perceptions of what will happen. And we've got a journey to take on in relation to that as well.
And the more people that obviously highlight these issues and report to you, the greater the picture you have of what's going on. So therefore, if, you know, whatever it might be, 101, perhaps the best way to get through, get it reported. And then the bigger the numbers, the more likely it is that perhaps more resources are pushed that way.
Absolutely. And that's the next steps in relation to this. And again, I'll happily come back in a few weeks or a couple of months' time to report further still to show what we've done around this. Because ultimately, the more information and intelligence we have, it allows us to put actual activity in place. So this was about translating what we thought the community felt into actually getting an understanding and reality of what they feel. And now it's the next. Already convened the first task and finish group in relation to this, which had a range of police and partner agencies in the room, people from lighting, people from community safety, police officers themselves. And we're going to extend it out now to wider transport networks and also those who own the nighttime economy and certain locations, so that we can start to test this now. And I'm going to be pushing to say, what actually are you going to be doing now to feed back to the community that we've listened? And that's the bit I want to come back to next, Chris, so that we can bring some real tangible evidence back to your listeners to show you that we do genuinely care and we are going to make this better.
I'm grateful for that, Simon. You've come back this time. We'll get you back again on that. Now, this is one aspect of personal crime. Also highlighted this week through tragedy is hate crime, and it's LGBT plus History Month as well. And I was talking to Councillor Chris Burden last week about the importance, again, of reporting. Don't let it just slip by, because, again, the more intelligence that you get in the police, the more that can be done.
Absolutely. And it reinforces the point I made earlier around people ensuring that we are told and are informed. What's worse than most things is the fear. And that's what's something that we, you know, we are actively seeking to change, because if people fear, it may restrict their abilities to go out and enjoy society. And we want to change that. We want people to feel safe. And all forms of hate crime shall not be tolerated. And the more people that can report it in, we will deal and we will react to it. And I can guarantee you that every morning at 8:30 in Wolverhampton, we look at all crime, especially our hate crime, examine it, understand it, and work out how we can do the right thing for the victim, but also stop it improving in the future. So please do get those calls into us. We do need the information.
And perhaps just to finish, to reassure people, as you said earlier, Wolverhampton is a low crime city, and therefore what I know, tackling fear of crime and perception of crime is different to tackling crime itself. But again, people, yes, if you feel afraid, you feel afraid, but actually low crime city, you know, there's some reassurance in that.
Absolutely. And, you know, we live in a society where lots of people get their beliefs and opinions from social media and what they read in the written and televised media. And we understand that. And unfortunately, you know, quite often people don't publish the great news around the safety and the work that's done to ensure that people are safe and low crime levels. However, that's our role to understand that, deal with that, tackle that. And the more we can use your medium and others to reassure people that it is a safe city, but that we will never take it for granted, the better.
Simon, thank you as ever.
Thank you, Chris. I much appreciate it. And I look forward to coming back and speaking to you and your listeners again in the near future.
Superintendent Simon Inglis of the Neighbourhood Policing Team here in Wolverhampton. There are a number of community shops being developed across the city of Wolverhampton to help with cost of living support. John Raj is the Bilston Support Network manager of the community shop, and also from the Bilston Strengthening Families Hub. That's quite a mouthful, isn't it? I caught up with him to find out how the shop was doing.
Very glad to say, joining me on the line now is John Raj of the Bilston Community Shop. Good afternoon, John.
Hi, good afternoon, Chris.
Good to see you. Thank you for joining us. Now, community shops, they've been growing up across the city, haven't they, supporting people in these difficult times. Tell us how it's going down in Bilston.
Okay, so we set up in September last year within the Strengthening Families Hub in Bilston. And what can I say? It just seemed to have grown month by month. And now we are close to nearly 950 members.
It's an incredible number. Now, I saw those numbers, quite staggering. Now, we know there's a cost of living crisis, but for many people, life is a crisis all the time, even when we haven't got these extra pressures as well. So are you finding you're reaching into the community in a way you've never done before?
I think at the moment, everybody is suffering. It doesn't matter whether they're working, they're not working, whether it's a family or a single person, everybody is seeing the effect of the cost of living crisis. So what we're able to do is reach out to the community and just do the best we can. Some of the unfortunate things that we see is a lot of elderly people who actually need the help, but they don't access the help. And one of the things that we haven't seen before is a lot of professionals coming to us. A lot of nurses and midwives and other professionals who we never had in the past few months. So that's very sad indeed.
When you say everybody's struggling, that highlights it, doesn't it? When you've got people who are in work, yeah, and have what people would think would be well-paid jobs by comparison, if they're struggling too. And you say the elderly are not accessing it. Is that because of they just don't know about it? Because they actually don't, they're very proud and they don't want to take charity, so to speak?
I think, Chris, the community shop, they pay a small membership just to join, but then they're able to buy the food. But they still feel that there's a stigma
right.
That they have. They're very proud. They don't want to see us as they taking or they're buying reduced items or what have you. But what I've seen is in the past, the ones who are most in need, they never ask for help.
Yeah, yeah. And it's important to the point you make there is that, yes, there's a membership fee, people join and then they can buy food at a reduced cost. But this actually, one of the things behind this was trying to reduce the stigma that, say, goes with food banks, where effectively it is a handout to people. Here, people are shopping, but at a more reasonable level in terms of cost.
That's correct, yeah. So what happens is... The community shop is, it gives the dignity back to the people. So at least they're spending their own money. So if they're spending £5 or £10 within the shop, they're able to, the retail value of the food that they're buying would be £20 plus. So it gives them the dignity, it gives them the option of buying what they need and how they want to. The difference that I can see when I ran the food bank in XL Church for the past 3 years, previous to joining the community shop, was in a food bank, you'll give them a bag of items that you think that they need or the best, the way that you think that they can access those items. With the community shop, it's set up as a normal shop, so they will come and pick what it is exactly they need, and they buy for and they pay for it. They're able to buy that produce, which gives the dignity back. But there's still a lot of people who think that somebody who's worse off them then should be coming in to access the shop. But the shop is as long as it's a Wolverhampton resident, it's open to anybody.
Yeah, and I think that's probably something you have to work on over time, isn't it, with regard to the stigma that's involved there. So you talk about people becoming members. How do people actually do that? Do they just come up along to the hub when it's opened? And I see you're open Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Fridays, 9:30 to 2:30. If they rock up at that time, they can sign up and that's how it starts?
Definitely. So they'll just come to the shop. A member of our team will just say it's a very simple form that they fill in. They bring just one form of ID and it's a one-off fee of £2 that they pay. They don't pay for that again. And then they have a membership to the shop. So they can come on Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Fridays and do their shopping, whatever they see. Whatever surplus stock that we have, we put in the foyer and that's all free. We don't charge for that
at all. And what about local businesses are also struggling, you know, and some ways you're taking trade off them. Have you found that's difficult in the area or are people just working together, recognising this is a special set of events?
I think at first we did, because we're based in the town centre, one of the decisions that we made was not to open on Thursday because Thursday is the main market day in Bilston. Obviously, the traders are all trying to make a living as well. So it wasn't fair for us to be selling produce that is cheaper than the market traders. But I think most of the business have supported us. They've come on board. But at the same time, there is different businesses who think that we shouldn't be there. So yeah. It's a difficult one.
But you have that sensitivity, obviously, towards the market by not opening on Thursdays, which is important as well. And what motivates you personally to get involved with something like this? Why is it important to you?
I think with my background, I used to... run a soup kitchen for, I think, about 7 or 8 years ago, and then with the food bank. And then it's just helping people. It's just helping people, giving them a hand up, then just trying to give them something. I think what happens is in Bilston, everybody looks after each other, everybody cares for each other. And, you know, some of the simple things, some of our members, they're doing some cooking or baking or something, and they'll bring a slice of the cake that they've cooked for you, and they'll bring you and say, "This is for you, John. This is for your team." We can just do the best that we can.
Yeah.
And as long as you love the people, and they will love you back, it's very simple.
Thanks, John. The shops right across the city, the ones that are open at the moment, is the Big Venture Community Shop on the Scotlands. There's yourself in Bilston. There's also Low Hill Community Shop and Eastfield Community Shop and Stratton Street as well. I sadly saw that Stratton Street had been broken into, which is very sad. Maybe a sign of the times that people sometimes are that desperate, or maybe it's just people, you know, misbehaving themselves as well. But there's a number across the city there, and if people log on to the council website, wolverhampton.gov.uk, they can find out all the different times and opening. I'll be here all day if I'm telling everybody what's open when, won't I? As well. John, thank you very much.
That's John Raj of the Bilston Community Shop. If you go to the show notes, you'll see a link there, but if you want to go directly, it's wolverhampton.gov.uk/cost-of-living-support, and all the shops are listed there. Jan Burns MBE is of Beacon Vision, and the organisation has developed a training offer for local businesses to help them support their employees with visual impairment. So it's great to be able to welcome Jan Burns MBE from Beacon Centre. Nice to see you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. Yeah, we're okay. And got this new course of business employees, obviously trying to raise awareness all the time around people and the way they struggle with sight loss.
Yeah, it's aimed to be proactive and preventative and supportive to people, especially employers who may employ people with sight loss, but equally people who provide services, who will have people and work with people who have sight loss, visual impairments, etc. And really just to support them in their understanding, both theoretically, I suppose we'd call it experiential learning, to give them an opportunity to learn how it is for a person with sight loss. And as I said, experiential learning. They will have the goggles on, they will have some practical training, but also the theory behind it that gives them information about eye conditions and such like. Because, you know, we think people are blind, they're not all have total blindness, don't all, not all see, they have certain amounts of different kinds of vision. And it's important really to understand what it's like for that individual to live with it and maybe to work with it.
Indeed. I remember chatting to your colleagues back during lockdown and the shopping and the one-way systems and the difficulty, all the things that those of us who are privileged to have sight take for granted, and the difficulties there. So this will be raising awareness, and the goggles sound interesting. Councillor Linda Leach was on recently with me, and she wanted awareness around dementia. She said, oh, she was absolutely, it blew her mind really in terms of what she learned. It's the best way of learning, isn't it?
Experiential. Yep.
Absolutely. So businesses can get in touch with her. They can find out about this. Is it delivered on their premises, or is it delivered by you? What are the practical sides of it?
Either way, to be truthful, we have got training rooms. We've got rooms at a Beacon where we can accommodate people, but equally we can come onto people's premises. What I'd say is it's important that one size doesn't fit all, and that we realise that we would rather work with someone first to make sure that it's a bespoke course and it does suit the needs of the people that they're trying to work with or employ or whatever it is in that domain. So it can be either way.
And does it cost them?
Yes, it costs £300 excluding VAT, and that's for like 12 delegates. And it's a 3-hour course.
Wow, so that's good value for money.
Very good value for money. We're a charity, yeah. And we understand. And what you've used the words already. Most importantly, we want to raise awareness and make a difference to people's lives, and that's one of our raison d'être. So, you know, certainly it fits in with what we want to do, how we want to do it, and how we want to make it more accessible for people.
Starting point, obviously, is that people want to help their colleagues, their employees, really. It's that heart and mind, and you're sort of enabling them to show them, well, this is the kind of thing you can do. Because often we struggle. We don't know how we support each other, but this would help them.
It would certainly help. And it's, as I said earlier, it helps to understand. I said about twice now, I've said experiential learning. I've just said it again.
I know. you get that in there.
No, but what I would say, I thought about it as I said it the last time. It's walking in someone's shoes. And when you walk in someone else's shoes, you start to have that compassion that gives you that understanding of how does it feel for them and how can we, and that's the aim of what this program's about, is how can we make life easier easier for the people themselves, not having to explain, I can't do this. From a positive and a strength-based approach, we can actually work with the people who provide services or who are working with people, because we'd like to do it for employers as well, is how can we help that person under equality to have those access to services that they should have? And it can be something so simple.
Simple, fun to learn. And how do people find out more?
Oh, they find out more is they contact us at Beacon, and they can contact us on the mainline number, and they can contact us via email.
That's great. I've got the number here, 01902 880111. I've got it under my nose, and we'll put it out again. When we repeat this interview on the podcast, I'll make sure the show notes have got the link there, as well as to your email address as well. Jan, thank you very much, and I'll be interested to hear how the courses go, who signs up, and what kind of experience they have. Maybe we'll get on a business that's learned from it.
It would be great to do that. I think it would be, because that helps others as well, doesn't it? So we're all there for that to happen. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you.
That's Jan Burns, MBE of Beacon Vision, and the links to Beacon Vision are in the show notes. And that's it for this week's podcast. If you have any stories or news, you can email me, chris@wcrfm.com, and I look forward to you joining me next time.
WCRFM. Chris Allen. This is WCRFM.